So we missed our tacky talk last week, so we've got to do double duty this week. Hi, Tacky.
Hey, Joe. Yeah, last week we attempted to take a vacation, a staycation, because, you know, we can't go anywhere, or I can't go anywhere. So we attempted that with sort of a little bit of success, put it that way.
Well, it's the new year, right, since last we talked? Happy Year of the Ox.
Yeah, Happy New Year, Ox. We celebrated Lunar New Year last Friday evening. The lunar calendar starts in the evenings. And we did a Zoom call that night with actually family from around the world. And we did like a breakout room between the older folks and the rest of us, so to speak. And we ended up
the kids' table, right? You were at the kids' table.
Still at the kids' table, folks. I'm still at the kids' table. Not graduated yet. Despite being the oldest one of that set of the generation, because we're generational sets, like my mom's generation, my grandma's generation. In my generational set, of my mom's family, I'm at the top of that food chain. And I'm still at the kids' table, everybody. So just to let you know, being born first doesn't let you off the kids' table. So what we did, like an hour of like trivia night, there's all kinds of games you can share on your Zoom screen. And we had a little bit of fun. You know, doing some trivia type things with little animations and whatnot. So it was a nice way to spend the evening with family.
Yeah, that's nice. Very nice. You know, best you can do under the circumstances. I haven't heard a lot of concern about, you know, the celebrations causing a surge in the virus. I think by this time, people finally have figured it out that you just can't do that.
Well, thankfully, the numbers have been declining in the last 10 days regarding hospitalization rates and infection rates. Now, mind you, we're still in four digits on infections, and we're still in double digits for deaths. We've been able to keep out of three digits mostly in the last couple of weeks, but we're trending in the right direction. I do believe that Thanksgiving, post-Thanksgiving, really put the fear of God into people, so to speak, about how serious infection rate has become, plus the new variants from South Africa, Brazil, and the UK, all of which have made appearances all over the United States and likely here as well, which could explain how come we've had so much more of our friends infected. I've hearing many more of my personal friends, not just in Quincy, but other locales, getting infected and having a hard time trying to figure out what happened, even though they were extremely cautious regarding gloves and masks and everything else. And it's one of those situations where we're constantly on alert. And I do understand COVID fatigue. I mean, it's extremely exhausting to constantly be super conscientious about, you know, sanitation, hand wipes, mask and so forth, and we're all getting tired. I mean, I am too. I mean, we're in the same boat. So, but given the higher infection rates back then, it shows that these new variants had to be here at some stage. But I mean, things are trending in the right direction. We have to continue to keep that trend going and limit our gatherings. And Chinese New Year was very subdued. There was no major events in Chinatown, no major events in Quincy or Malden. I do not, you know, Boston, Vietnamese population had a video, New Year's, Quincy Asian Resources did a video New Year's as well. It inhibits a lot of fundraising this time of year. Chinese communities, social organizations and services organizations do raise money during Chinese New Year. So this is going to be the second year of their fundraising cycle, basically being taken away.
Mm.
So we all know that there's a huge impact on PTOs and social service organizations and all our old charity groups that we do support and love. The Chinese ones tend to raise most of the money during the New Year's period.
Sure. Yeah, it just makes perfect sense. You know, that's the most active time. So that's their major fundraising time too, sure.
There's two traditions are part of Chinese New Year as well. One is eating out. So even though the government did raise restaurant limitations, there is a degree of, you know, racism going on as well regarding utilization of Asian stores products have been going on since last December.
Mm.
But also, you know, restaurant limits, if you're a smaller restaurant, it's still very challenging this time of year. You have a 2-week zone where you're filled to the brim for two or so weeks in a Chinese restaurant. And part of Chinese New Year includes buying something new. Now, we're not talking about like going to Jordan's Furniture and refurbish your own home. I mean, you know, you go out and buy some new items for you and your family as part of Chinese New Year. And it's a big part of the economy. You know, and overseas is the same thing. Chinese New Year is a big part of many Chinese communities, Vietnamese communities, economies, Korean economies. where they gear their entire two-week period or so towards the New Year event. So dining out, buying new items. Like I said, not always, you don't have to buy big items, I mean, even small items. Believe it or not, cleaning products, just like spring cleaning concept, you know, New Year's, going into New Year's, you want to clean everything up. And also it's a travel period, you know, to travel to see your family, but also travel to see your friends and basically pay respect for New Year's at other people's homes, particularly older people. Generally, it's the younger folks go to the older folks' home.
That's right, the right. Yep.
So maybe they need to drag us out of bed for that.
Well, I mean, obviously the key to getting all of these things going again is, you know, the vaccines. And it's been fits and starts here in Massachusetts, as you're well aware, the rollouts. What do you think? What do you think about it, Jackie?
Well, it's a bloody disaster. I mean, there's no other way to put it at this point. I mean, today, what, Friday the 19th. So, you know, it's been a couple of weeks since we last chatted. But I mean, the governor's messaging continues to be enormously confusing because it's unclear what they're really saying to us because it keeps changing. Mm-hmm. And this is all foreseeable and knowledgeable stuff that we should be able to resolve. I mean, Ticketmaster can manage a boatload of tickets during the World Series on an overloading system. However, the governor decides to hire a small nonprofit, which doesn't seem to know the fact that you only have 90,000 slots and 1 million people trying to log in at the same time in a massive race. How did they not think this was not going to happen in a city where we have sporting events, concerts, which have to know how to manage load and limited space numbers available? I mean, this is what I find rather appalling. It's like, dude, this is like the real world situation. I mean, we spent a whole summer people trying to buy online cleaning products in droves, overwhelming shopping systems that operate on a national level, but they can't figure out how to hire a company that, you know, when you say you got 90,000 slots for 1 million people, that is not going to result in another system crash like it did about a month ago when they opened up the 75, well, not a month, 2 weeks ago when that 75 age above also do the same thing. This is the thing that I find appalling. It's like, this isn't like something we haven't seen before in any sector. Meanwhile, we all have existing technology challenges regarding the RMV. I've got continuation of Department of Unemployment. I mean, I'm getting 2 emails a day or calls a day average now on people having problems with unemployment claims, not just on the customer service and on the phone side, but also on the website side as well. And, you know, RMVs migrated completely over to online on renews and everything else, you know, beyond using just AAA, you know, on a scheduling system. You know, this is not a new problem throughout state government and the private sector. So, you know, the fact that they act like, well, how could this happen? Like, have you not been watching the rest of the world? Mm. And this causes a serious question about the governor's judgment on getting vendors. Why are they using these vendors? And personally, I don't like the state website. I don't know about the rest of you all, but I do not like navigating my own state website. And if I've done the feedback function, say, hey, tell us what you think. I basically say it's awful. So they use my, you know, State House email to tell them it's awful. And the bot doesn't know I'm a rep or not. I mean, I'm just yet another user, which is fine. You know, it's a mess. So not surprisingly, this thing crashed. And it's shocking because there's better ways to do this. I mean, we you know, have an existing healthcare system. You know, you could have people, you know, schedule through the existing healthcare system as opposed to using a centralized portal. And that's the part I find like crazy ass. I mean, I got an email from Atrius Healthcare telling me that they will have Moderna vaccine for people age 65 and above. Do not kill their system. This is what they said. You know, we'll let you know when scheduling appointments can start. Not unreasonable. Man, a community health center was able to manage the schedule despite not having, you know, having infinite vaccine. They have limited vaccine numbers and were able to their own scheduling process, reaching out to patients age 65 and over, and they have medical records of people who age 65 and over with medical conditions to start doing the outreach.
Yeah. What about, you know, redirecting these vaccines away from these community health centers and municipal run vaccination clinics to the mass vaccination sites? It seems counterintuitive. Older folks are saying, I don't want to go to Gillette Stadium and Fenway Park and, you know, Springfield and have to do it twice too. I'd rather go to my local VFW or, you know, Board of Health or whatever? Doesn't that make more sense?
Well, it's an issue of twofold. One is the fact we are not getting a monstrous number of vaccines. I mean, as you saw the governor talk about recently, which is true, I mean, they were looking to redirect vaccine because of the fact that the weather has made it very difficult to vaccine shipments up here. Vaccine manufacturing is only in very specific locations, and winter has hit. And winter has hit this country very hard this month of February. And they were looking to, like, redirect some vaccine to other locales. And, you know, thankfully, the governor and the congressional delegations up here are like, no, we'll go get it ourselves if we have to. You know, this is ridiculous. We're not going to slow down our injections because of weather. I mean, we can figure out how to get stuff transported if you let us cooperate. Secondly, I think the thought process is that we only have a limited amount of vaccines. It does have a shelf life. This stuff does not last long. So, and it's a high degree of maintenance to maintain, you know, its viability because of the refrigeration component. So the goal is to vaccinate as many people as possible in the shortest time possible. So right. To figure that if you're not using a doctor's office, who may not have a regular doctor, a mass vaccination site makes sense. But it also makes it more difficult, as you pointed out. Locale is more challenging, and you got to have trust in your medical community where you go there. I've had people tell me they've been to Gillette. Once you get there and go in, it's not bad. Scheduling's a horror show. Once you get inside, it's not so horrible. Mm-hmm. People are very efficient, very smooth when move through. But you, at the same time, though, why can't you use existing doctors' groups to be able to notify patients themselves of who are the highest at risk because they have the medical records?
Right. It would seem if you really want to vaccinate as many people as quickly as possible, you'd make it available as many places as possible.
And please, if you're vaccinated already, contact your doctor to update your medical records. This is very important. I mean, part of the vaccination program is to make sure your medical records update. That's why they need to go to an insurer and things like that. And you don't know who your doctors are, so they can get information there. But you yourself should inform your own doctors to update your medical records. This is crucial so that your doctor's groups will not reach out to you. You have been vaccinated. Saves them time so you can move on to the next person.
Okay, good point. I had not heard that before.
Yeah, no, it's very important. I'm aware that, you know, they are trying to make sure that the record's up to date, but you yourself should take some initiative to make sure that's true. You shouldn't, I would not rely on them to do that for you.
Yeah.
I took my mom's Tufts Medical for her first vaccination. You know, it was like three Scantron components to get to the needle. And they did like a check, verifications, updated the medical records and all that stuff. And since she's also Manit Community Health Center patient, you know, oncology has matched her up with Manit as a referral. The record should, the electronic record should sync up regarding the vaccination.
Yeah.
And the caretaker of someone who's over age 75 with cancer, I actually did not qualify because I found out after that started that, you know, I'm not getting vaccinated. And the reason's because the vaccination is through the state's web portal. But my mom was called by Tufts Medical.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So I did receive some confusion on that as well, including myself. And I'm like, well, okay, well, that means I'm not getting vaccinated to stage three, which is fine. I'm not complaining here. But there's really a confusion issue of messaging. Oh, you can take your loved one with you. Yeah, but I already took my loved one to Tufts Medical. Oh, you can still get your first shot during the second shot if you schedule through the portal. But right. We didn't schedule that way.
Yeah, that is confusing for sure. People don't understand that the different sites are run by different entities, you know, and it matters.
It does matter because you want to go to a place where you feel comfortable and medically to get your shot. And if you have a pre-existing condition or you're older, it is essential that you have a comfort level in case, Lord forbid, something could go wrong because there's still a very minute possibility you can't. And you should be prepared for that. I mean, as I, you know, keep reminding folks, I do have my, you know, EpiPens here, and I do get my immunization shots for my various food allergies as this immunization program. But I'm in there for 30 minutes, and I've done this for, well, COVID basically stopped my program for about 7 or so months, actually longer. But regardless, I mean, there's a whole protocol around that, and I do it in a medical setting because, you know, I could die. So
a little technicality, yeah.
A little technicality, folks. Yeah. I could kick the bucket doing my immunization shots. So, but it's essential that I take those precautions, during COVID, and I do go to Atrius Healthcare, and I'm very thankful they do a very good job in scheduling and, a lot of COVID protocols on the way in the door. And, all of us got to do what we got to do to resume medical care.
Will Manette still be able to do their clinic on Old Colony Avenue going forward, now that the vaccines are being redirected?
At the moment, Manette Community Health Center's website is still taking appointments for 65 above. They do warn on the website that, vaccinations are limited subject to supply. But the thing advantage of that is the fact that when they know things come up and you're in the queue of the scheduling program, they can reach out to you when you get it. Mm-hmm. Other states have done programs like text messaging. Those of you who subscribe to CVS pharmacy, which is what I do, when my medication's ready, I get a text message saying, "Well, hold it for 2 weeks."
Yeah.
No, in 7 days, they don't respond or show up. They text me again. The technology exists for scheduling. It makes sense where you can schedule in advance, whether through your medical provider or through a pharmacy or through the state portal, which I don't really recommend right now, that they could respond back to you at a future date that they have vaccine available. And if they have your medical records, they can prioritize you based on your medical conditions. This is not a hard concept. That is, a technology has been used, like everything from reservations at restaurants. You could do this on open table, for Pete's sakes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And at the same time, through your pharmacy, and I get text messages from Harvard Vanguard Atrius regarding my shots today. I got like a text, 2 days ago, a text today. I respond, yes, I'll be there. And, my app on my health on that will let me do online check-in if that's my sole desire, but I actually prefer checking in person because I don't like because of COVID protocols, they make you check in person anyway. So it really doesn't. And they're billing me. So as opposed to paying, they're just going to bill me because it's, reduce human contact as much as possible.
Yeah. Speaking of billing, I was surprised to learn that insurance companies can, be billed basically for shots if you have insurance.
Yes. The shots themselves have been paid by the federal government.
Yeah.
So the active medication, the manpower for said shot is not.
Okay.
So if you go to your medical provider, they can bill insurance for the labor involved.
Okay.
There should be no cost to you.
Right.
The insurance company will pick up that end because you think about it. Well, who's getting paid to inject you? Seriously.
Right. Yeah.
I think probably don't think about it because you get your shot. It's only, quickly for, a few minutes of the shot itself, seconds to inject. Mm-hmm. You have to do the whole paperwork process, which takes some time. And then you got to do that 15 to 30 minute wait, depending on your conditions. And you have a medical person there watching you during that 15 to 30 minutes.
Yeah, they all have to be paid, of course. Yeah.
You have to be here somehow. It's one person per shot, but you think about the course of a day, that's a lot of people and manpower and time.
Sure.
The actual medication is paid by the federal government. The rest of it is through the insurance I'm trying to think if anybody wouldn't be able to bill insurance. I don't think anybody would be because it's all done through medical facilities, urgent care, pharmacies, all groups that are already part of the insurance billing system.
Sure. Yeah. And of course, there's costs, as you pointed out before, with all the gear that goes with that, the masks, the gowns, the gloves, the syringes, the facilities themselves. Yeah.
Oh, the sheer number of alcohol wipes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they wipe your arm like twice. They wipe my mom's arm, twice a minimum before they do the injection.
Sure.
Just to do an exceeding level of caution. So, I don't think there's a good time to be cheap on this. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, no, we saw what happened with that when they tried to outsource the website.
Well, there you go. Yeah. You're absolutely correct. I do know that the Massachusetts voters and constituents and the residents here, Massachusetts people do believe that we should be frugal of our money. But this is a health crisis. I think we need to not be cheap about it.
Yeah. Do you think that's what happened? Do you think that the governor was trying to save money and went with this small organization? I think it was a prep mod or something.
I'm not sure how they did this bid. out there. Massachusetts subbid law requires getting the lowest bidder possible that can be able to do the work. If it's a contract of less than 50 grand, there's a lot more flexibility in issuing those contracts, actually both the municipal and the state level. So we're not entirely clear what happened here. The Speaker and the Senate President have formed a COVID-19 committee, which you saw in the papers this week, and he also formed a federal assistance census committee to do oversight regarding federal funding, because one of the things that we required in one of the past stimulus packages, we were under the stimulus economic development packages, requires that that the governor has to put some disclosure publicly about where our federal money has been spent. So we are actively pursuing the use of the federal funds, what we're doing with state funds, and what is going on in the implementations program. So while we've had a special task force on COVID-19 throughout the pandemic, we have formalized two committees whose job is to look into the federal assistance and the COVID-19 outreach. And I want to congratulate our colleague, Bill Driscoll from Milton, which I've mentioned before on a podcast, who is the only one I know that anybody knows anything about emergency management, because that's what he does for a living before coming to the legislature. And I've learned a ton of stuff from Bill on everything of how to get things from point A to point B to, you know, what do you do in an earthquake? I mean, Bill knows all that kind of stuff. And even though this is not a conventional natural disaster, some of the aspects of that can be applied today, everything from PTSD-ish stress down to how to move things from point A to point B. And, you know, even Bill will tell me straight up, we're doing things on the fly here they've never seen before because we've never been here before.
Right.
Well, there is a degree of patience involved regarding the learning curve as we try to figure it out.
Yeah.
So I have a lot of confidence in Bill and Senator Comerford, his co-chair, on getting moving on oversight hearings and making inquiries to the administration what's going on. And our other colleague, Dan Hunt, who represents that one precinct in Quincy.
3-3, yes.
up there, if you don't know, guys know, that's the one across along the Neponset River, the DAC section, to do some oversight regarding the governor's use of federal funds. And also the fact the census has been delayed to September on information, they're going to give us the data. He's going to do some oversight on that as well, on information distribution in the census. So congratulations to two of our South Shore colleagues on becoming chairman and strengthening the South Shore. Well, Dan Hunt's not South Shore. He's Dorchester. So let's make that clear. Okay, you're still a dark kid, Dan. But, you know, strengthening our position south of Boston in leadership in the House.
Well, yeah, and to our own John Keenan, and to you too, Tacky, for your committee assignments.
Yeah, I'm back on the Joint Committee of Consumer Protection Professional Legislature. This is a committee I've chaired since I was appointed midterm in 2017. I'm very happy to return to this role. I did talk to the Speaker, and people have asked me, which I find kind of exhausting, why didn't I get anything else better? I'm like, yeah, it's only better if you think it's better. I mean, what you think is better isn't what I think is better.
Exactly, yeah. You know, the behind the scenes of what's going on, for sure, yeah. Well, it just makes sense for continuity's sake, I think, as well.
Exactly. I mean, right now I'm managing a staff of five, and it's been actually, anybody's been managing through this format, whether it be five people or 50 people or 500 people, has been finding it's very hard.
Yeah.
And my work involves a lot of interpersonal connections, not just with the, you know, outside world, but also inside the office, where I can answer your question or do a briefing with my own staff in 15 minutes. It's now taking much more time when passing information back and forth. I can't look over your shoulder and help move through something. Now we're trying to learn how to use Google Doc via Microsoft 360 simultaneous typing, when I'm seeing different initials with cursors changing things on the fly of a document. I am not that old, but I'm also not that young anymore. Right. And I'm just like, slow down, everybody. I can't keep up with your cursors. What just changed in this document? So this is kind of the real world things we're dealing with. And this committee, as I remind folks, is a very powerful committee. I have oversight division professional licensure, the alcohol industry, car franchise industry, anything related to consumer protection. I have the state lottery, I have the racetrack, I have intellectual property, I have privacy laws, I have certain aspects of the technology, I have some little bit of oversight over the boards of allied health. You know, I have to interact with three constitutional officers. I have to interact with, you know, well into 50 plus different special interest groups. And there isn't an industry that doesn't have a consumer issue at some point, or they either want to change or create or demolish a licensing structure, depending on the industry you're talking about. Yeah. So
think about all the professions that need licenses, you know, estheticians, funeral directors, I mean, all of it, yeah.
Approximately 15% of the state's population has some form of licensing that's related to this committee. If you count the medical community and whatnot, that jumps to 20-25% of the state requires some kind of licensing. So I do not have licensing over all licenses. So let's get that out there. People have this idea that I deal with all of my, I do not deal with all the licenses, but I do a substantial portion of the professions out there. Mm-hmm. So I'm very happy that the Speaker Mariano has reappointed me to this committee. There are a lot of choices out there, open assignments. But I feel that this is a good position for me now, and I do enjoy the work. Congratulations to Senator Moran from Plymouth area, who's actually won her election, a special election, COVID last year. COVID election, special elections can be extremely grueling because of the truncated time frame. Yeah. And the fact that you have a mask on and no one knows who you are when you have a mask on, that doesn't help. Also congratulate my colleague, John Keenan. He moves from post audit and oversight to housing. Mm-hmm. And housing is a major issue, generally speaking. But more so in COVID, dealing with things like mortgage foreclosures, we continue to need affordable housing. There's a flight out of Boston now for people buying homes in the suburbs, which is changing the housing prices and the rental prices. And now with unemployment still very challenging for folks and then wait for another stimulus package, you know, the issue on people paying rent now also falls into John's purview. So John's got a real big order of business to do beyond just our normal issues in housing now into the COVID world.
Yes, and he's vice chair of transportation now as well. So that's going to be another whole area that's going to be changing.
Yeah, the governor signed into law the $16 billion transportation bond bill not too long ago. That basically is the biggest infrastructure bond we've done since the Big Dig. And even then, the Big Dig was really federally funded. Mm-hmm. Most part, I think it was very highly federally funded, and it was also paid for by turnpike tolls. And this turnpike tolls are still paying the debt on the bond bill, by the way.
Interesting.
So that's not quite over yet. So John's got some real big tasks going on, and I want to congratulate Bruce Ayers for making vice chair of financial services, mm-hmm. which oversees the banking and insurance industries. And the chair of that is Jamie Murphy from Weymouth. So we have two South Shore folks on an extremely powerful and important committee regarding banking insurance industries. And Walter Timothy, the senator from Milton, is now chair of public safety. And our friend Mark Huzak, the rep from Braintree, he's still chairing revenue, which is basically called taxation.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the millionaire's tax is coming up again for a vote to put on the Constitution.
Oh, yeah. What do you think about that, Jackie?
Well, let me back up. The state has a flat tax system by constitution. We're not allowed to do a tiered tax system like the federal government and other states. So those who look at the taxes realize that you have, you know, 15%. I believe I'm in a 28% tax bracket based on how much you make, you know, follows the brackets. Here, it's a flat tax on same type of income. So earned income is different from passive income, which is different from capital gains and so forth and so forth, which means you can have different flat tax for each type of different income. So the millionaire's tax seeks to add get you to 10% from the 5% for every dollar above $1 million you have in earned income.
Earned income, okay.
So if you make like $1.2 million and after all your deductions you have, you know, an income of $750,000, this wouldn't affect you.
Gotcha, okay.
So it's every dollar over 1 million. And the money is to be, you know, utilized for things like education and transportation. It's a constitutional amendment. So we passed it last year. We're going to pass it this year, most likely, because I don't see the vote total changing. And it'll be put on the ballot, hopefully in the 2022 year, before voters decide if they want to change the constitution to allow a specialized flat tax.
Hmm.
I think that Chairman Huzak, you know, from Braintree is going to have to shepherd through the House Constitutional Convention.
Okay. Okay. Do you support it yourself?
I voted for last time. I'm supportive of the amendment. you know, it's not necessarily unusual. There are states that do have graduated income taxes, which we don't, and this creates not even truly giving the legislature graduated income tax power. We wouldn't get that. It's just a very specific tax structure for a very specific demographic. So, for people who are concerned that legislatures could be given graduated income tax ability, well, no, we don't. It's still going to maintain flat taxes, so it creates a flat tax on top of another flat tax.
Okay. So it'll be a flat rate for anything over $1 million earned income.
Yeah, because the Constitution mandates how we do taxation. So, we'll see how it goes, but it'll be interesting because we'll probably have to hold a constitutional convention in March, I believe, was it April? There's a whole calendar that the state constitution requires minimum meetings of constitutional convention issues.
And by so March, I don't see that as being an in-person meeting right now.
No, we're still working virtually. I do not anticipate any kind of in-person meetings coming up. Bill filing deadlines today on the 19th. It doesn't still file bills after 19th, but they won't be timely in terms of referral to committee. We won't see bills likely to sometime in late May at this stage regarding referral to committees. The hearings, talking to my co-chair and my staff about how to do virtual meetings. Those of us have been sitting in front of a screen all year long, including your children, understand the challenges to things, your attention span, your back, your glossy-eyed. Focusing and paying attention to this format takes a lot of energy.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of trying to decide how we're going to manage hearings. We can't do walk-ins anymore like we do in person. You can just walk in and just decide to testify. It's got to be a much more orderly format, and I do want to maintain transparency as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
However, it's likely we're going to get off of Zoom, which we've been doing this past fall. We did like seven hearings this past fall through Zoom format and migrating to Microsoft Networks 360 for security purposes.
Mm-hmm.
It's harder to be Zoom bombed, essentially,
yeah,
through Microsoft 360. And we got to figure out how to do a timer because people tend to talk like I'm doing now, on and on and on. You have to respect of other people seeing to testify too.
Yeah. It's the new normal, as they say, you know, so it's time to adapt and change and figure it out.
Yeah, I see some of this new normal staying permanently. As I've been telling my friends, you know, I still fully expect perhaps 50% of the white collar workforce not going back into Boston. And the ripple effect it has on the commercial economy in Boston, which is 50% of the economic engine in Massachusetts, if not New England, and the effect on commercial property prices, the less tolerable people leaving Boston for housing, an effect on MBTA because a lot of people do take the T and the commuter rail, south of Boston, go to work, and it may address a lot of car traffic issues as well. So even if they're doing staggered work schedules, or maybe just need to come into Boston for specific meetings, you may not have to because it's virtual, and then you got the travel problem. So I do know people are traveling, but over time, you're going to see more transportation agencies requiring demonstration of vaccination before boarding.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I was wondering about that.
Yeah, I can see that happening over time, particularly if you're going to be in confined spaces for long periods where your infection rate options go dramatically higher because you're basically moving, in a confined space. I mean,
right. Yeah. And we don't know if we'll need, you know, a shot every year, like the flu shot with this, or at least a booster shot. We have no idea right now.
No, we don't. I mean, this is the fastest created vaccine in human history because of technology that we have. And mRNA technology has been something worked on for decades. This isn't suddenly a magic suddenly appeared magic technology. It's something that's been going on in science for a long time. So it's given it ability to accelerate. So for example, in China, they're still using the old fashioned flu vaccine process where they take that virus, destroy it, and then put in the necessary RNA components of that virus into your body. But that means you have to manufacture the virus in a lab.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, mRNA does not manufacture viruses in a lab. There's no concern about that. Instead, it creates replication of the DNA structure, protein molecules, to teach your body how to address anything that looks like this disease, specifically the spike protein. It's like the fingerprint, for the lack of, it's probably not the right analogy. The science community is not at it, but essentially looking for a fingerprint snapshot of the spike protein show up it tries to attach itself to your body goes like, you're not supposed to be here, let's go kill it.
Right.
So there'll be other technologies coming up. I know that in Europe, they're looking at science, looking just specifically at spike proteins to just target at one aspect so your body sees it right up front, it goes and kills it. So you're going to see more of this type of technology moving forward of other countries as well. And it actually is opening a very interesting idea of beyond COVID vaccination. You know, how is the technology going to be used to address things like cancer?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
To diseases, you know, the flu even over a long period of time. So again, you know, the speaker brags and I brag as well. Massachusetts has made a massive investment in biotechnology for well into a decade now. And, you know, a lot of that has truly come to fruition and root because of our investments. And this country's using technology, which isn't really being used in the rest of the world.
Let's talk a little bit about the power grid in Texas, Dackie. And can that ever happen here?
No, it's unlikely to happen in Massachusetts. I do have a lot of friends who are very environment supporting, green energy supporting. I get criticized quite a few times regarding my much more conservative nature about renewable power. But Texas is the example of that. I mean, you know, 25% of all refinery in the United States, if not North America, is actually based in Texas. So the presumption is that their energy supply is all oil-based or gas-based coming out of the refineries. As demonstrated by the ice storms, that's not true.
Mm.
Texas is the only state that is pretty much its own inter-system operator for about three quarters of the state. I think it bleeds a little bit to Mexico and in its neighboring states to the west, but it's one of the few states where it has its own interconnect system operator, ISO. I can never remember the anagrams, but for those who don't know, ISO is the entity by federal government who's charged to manage the energy distribution transmission system in your area. So your transmission system is managed by one entity who's charged to ensure that the grid is powered up at the transmission level. Your local electric company, you know, in this case, NSTAR and Engrid is in charge of distribution, small wires that come through. But they're, you know, but they report to ISO if there's an energy shortfall, the transmission line will show there's an energy shortfall and they have to buy spot power.
Mm-hmm.
Solar and wind, they don't have offshore wind. Offshore wind doesn't exist in Massachusetts, in this country, truly. We're going to do that for the first time in our waters in Rhode Island and Massachusetts, pursuant to the state guaranteeing purchases on the best bid of big wind. They have land-based wind over there. And now we've seen the limitation regarding major snowstorms in wide areas where solar panels are covered and big windmills are now iced over. And that has resulted in interruption power in Texas where, you know, honestly, they're not designed for winter. I mean, they don't need to insulate their homes like we do.
Right.
And they don't use as much fossil fuel heating. Gas is the number one heating option in New England. A lot of guys there use electric, particularly warmer states, because they don't need to heat their homes that often. But it created enormous stress on the grid beyond just power outage of lineage coming down. So, you know, as I've said before, you need to have 100% functional electrical supply system at all times. And also be able to address power increased needs as it suddenly happens unexpectedly, such as you've seen in Texas where they have to run heating plus regular power. And it's resulted in brownouts. Now, I love people to tell me, oh, that's perfectly fine. Yeah, well, if your mom is freezing to death at age 80, are you going to tell your mom that's perfectly fine? I love it when people act like, oh, yeah, it's not a big deal. Mm. Fine. Well, you go tell your parent that's shivering to death that that's okay. I mean, I refuse to take this holier-than-thou attitude about this stuff. You know, people should not are paying for this resource, and people should get their money's worth for this resource. So Texas really needs to rethink both at the ISO level as well as the policy at the government level how to ensure safe, reliable power to their consumers. Massachusetts has done that. I mean, we continue to use a bridge in terms of the natural gas. But as hydro comes online with the new transmission line coming down from Maine, hopefully within the next 3 years, we'll have a steady supply of hydropower from Canada, which has 99.9% reliability short of ice storms taking down wires.
Right.
And you saw a lot of news trucks in Fitchburg specifically because back in 09, 08, 09 winter, they had that massive ice storm that brought down power as much as a full month. The reason I know this is because I worked that case in the AG's office regarding customer service problems in the ice storm.
Mm.
Their complete failure to have their emergency equipment ready to go as a result, which was shocking that no one died as a result of the power outage. Because people into Alice machines, refrigeration for medication, people on OSPD, OCPD issues regarding oxygen tanks at home. A lot of people have a lot of medical equipment at home.
Yes. Yep.
You have no power. The batteries only go for so long. And if you're going a month with no power, this is troublesome. So, energy is still extremely important to us at so many levels. And, I continue to be very supportive of more renewable power, but with the knowledge that I do not want someone to die because the dialysis machine dies at home, or they can't get their oxygen tank because the battery dies because of a long-term power outage, or a forced brownout by the utility company to make sure the system isn't overtaxed.
Yeah, it's a concern here in Quincy. I know actually a National Grid is coming before the city council soon at their request to explain how they're maintaining the infrastructure. There's some concern about frequent outages here in Quincy.
Yeah, Montclair, Walston area up in North Quincy has seen power outages that happened last week regarding that. I know it's an older system up here and there's a lot of trees and wires. And one of the balancing acts we have is cutting tree limbs.
Mm-hmm.
People don't like it. It looks ugly. But if a limb goes down, isn't like the neighbors go after that homeowner who didn't want that tree cut. I've never seen that happen either. You blame the utility company in the city for why that tree limb went down. I mean, if people really want to be rationally thinking and you have a neighbor that's opposing having a tree limbs cut around that wire and the wire in the tree limb comes down, well, guess who's the one that objected to that, guys? You can point the finger strictly at the person that wanted that.
Right.
But also the older infrastructure system here, the wires do need to be updated. There is a new cable that's going to come down Newport Avenue out of North Quincy down Furnishbrook Parkway heading for Quincy Point that is actually the same age as I am. It's over 47, 48 years old, and it's just worn out its lifespan.
Sure.
The distribution system at small wire level does need to be upgraded, every 30 to 60 years. We have transformers closing in 100 years old. That also needs to be completely replaced.
Hmm.
So, we've had a few more power outages here. Most people don't realize that we have two major transmission lines, one coming out of Boston, one coming southbound, which originally was the old Pilgrim nuclear power plant line. So Quincy has actually been very fortunate on not as many power outages on a transmission level, even though we're underwater and we're the last one to get power.
Right.
The Everett power plant, for example, is the one in Greater Boston area, and we get power from north, and then Pilgrim's closed, but there's still other power plants south from us coming up that direction too. So this area really doesn't experience nearly as much power outages as a result of the transmission level. There's been unusually high power outages this past winter, particularly in North Quincy section that we're aware of.
Yep. So we'll see how that National Grid agreed to come. So, kudos to them for that. We'll see what transpires.
Well, here's another little trivia fact. National Grid is one of the biggest property tax payers in the city.
Ah, interesting.
Every pole, every underground cable is subject to property taxes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And
so as a commercial property taxpayer, they are, if not one of the big, one of the biggest ones in the state. I mean, not in the state, in the city.
Yeah.
But utility companies, Verizon and National Grid do pay for that little section of sidewalk they use that's subject to property taxes, and that adds up over time.
Not aware of that. Okay, good to know.
So,
do you want to clarify your position on the Safe Communities Act, Tacky?
Yeah, seems to be a little bit of confusion. What I thought was a fairly clear statement in the state of the legislature this past week. This is an issue that's been ongoing in the legislature for well past a decade, and I've received people that have opposed it and supported the issue over the course of the years. And fundamentally, let's get to the fundamentals, because the bill keeps changing on you. It's not the same bill that we looked at over a decade ago. And what it does is limit the state's role regarding immigration enforcement. And it has ranged over the years from straight up banning local law enforcement from engaging in immigration enforcement to accepting federal money on that, and also not cooperating with the federal government regarding enforcement. So the reality is this, and let's put this as simple as possible. Nobody likes to do more work they're not being paid for. And the jurisdictions are fairly clear regarding immigration. The Constitution puts citizenship powers within Congress, and that is a federal jurisdiction issue. So should local law enforcement try to enforce immigration policies, they actually have zero authority to do so, nor do they have the capacity to process, detain, or put them someplace or try them. I mean, that's not a state court issue. The policy issue behind this is that the idea of you pass this law will result in greater confidence and cooperation between the immigrant community and people of color with law enforcement. Well, if you pass a law like that, you have some basic assumption that suddenly magically people have confidence in the local government. And confidence in local government comes from relationships with local government. And it is the responsibility of government to reach out to people they serve to create trust and confidence in them, that if there is a crime or any need they may have, they are comfortable that they feel safe and respected by the government that serves them, regardless of the immigration status. I mean, you know, I remember back on, people was, you know, there was advocacy groups going around saying that you should deny undocumented immigrants and maybe even some people here legally on visas access to emergency services. That was actually advocated to my office back when I first got elected. And that's really appalling when you think about it, particularly now in COVID-19. Mm-hmm. People actually believe that if you've been murdered, raped, or assaulted, that you should be denied police assistance. The police would not tolerate that policy either. The safety of the public at whole is the responsibility of the government and each other. So that is kind of the basic idea, is that you pass this law somehow magically these groups will come forward because a law protects them. One, you got to teach them what the law is. Two, the state does not do immigration, nor does the municipal government, because we're not being paid to do it and we don't have jurisdiction anyway. And it's still the responsibility of local government to build those relationships with new people in their community. So this is kind of the rub I'm having across, you know, the policy is to create trust in government, which they don't know the law exists, nor they know how the current law exists.
And so yes, you think it's a waste of time?
Well, it's troubling that this is the thought process. Yes, there are state troopers during the Deval Patrick administration did take some immigration money for enforcement issue. I believe it was a task force of 5 state troopers, which discontinued at some point, and I don't know if the Baker administration reinitiated. And we are aware that in particular, the sheriff of Bristol County does detain people waiting for processing in federal court on immigration violations. But at the same time, when you talk to local police and state troopers, they do process people that commit a crime like everybody else. Mm-hmm. Everybody, you and I, will also be run through their central criminal database system, which includes an ICE component. If it's flagged as a person that has violated their status, whether it be undocumented or you have a visa violation, it'll be flagged. If there's no response from the federal government, you're just treated like everybody else, booked and released, unless you murdered someone. Guy commit a very violent felony for you to be, you know, put up really fast and no bail.
Right.
Feel like everybody else. But if they don't come for you, they're not going to hold you because they're not getting paid to. It's not their job.
Right.
In every jurisdiction anyway. So, I mean, this is kind of the thing that if we educated communities on the facts I just gave you, that helps develop trust within those communities that it's okay to come forward.
Trust seems to be the big issue. It's you can't legislate trust.
That's correct. And a badge is a badge. I mean, let's be honest about this, folks. I mean, if you see a badge, do you know which law enforcement you're looking at? Is it the county sheriff? Is it municipal police? Is it a state trooper? Unless you really look really close and you can actually read the badge because you have English skills to do so. And even then, do you know what the jurisdictions are? For example, people still believe that if you're being traced by state troopers and go on municipal roads, the state trooper can't issue a ticket.
They'll be surprised if that's what they think.
Police reform back in the early 90s unified the entire state's jurisdictions where you have cross-jurisdictional issues where law enforcement can issue tickets across municipal lines and on state property. And on emergency calls, any police officer, regardless of jurisdiction, you know, closest, does have the right to go into a jurisdiction to address emergency situations.
Yes.
So Queen Shore Drive is a state road. The presumption is that the municipal police does not have jurisdiction in emergency situations. That is not true. City cops have the right to go onto state properties in emergency situations. You call 911 because, no joke, people have set off, you know, blowing up fireworks on someone's lawn, which is a danger. City cops call 911. They're supposed to go down there to keep more damage from happening.
Yes, absolutely. They, you know, they'll bring the state in too eventually, and there may be a state police report filed along with the city police report. But initially, yeah, the closest one is going to get there first.
And the police will work out jurisdictional issues on their own regarding who is right of arrest.
Correct. Yep.
And who's going to do the processing? They'll figure that out on their own.
Right.
So you know, there's been incidents on city roads where state troopers do Good Samaritan checks. They call in the city police, you know, inform them what's happening. City police come out. This is the cooperation of law enforcement. So, I mean, that myth still exists, even though it's been out of date for well past 30 years, which I find pretty interesting when I listen to folks. So, I mean, there's a lot of myths regarding jurisdictional issues that need to be dispelled. If you're not an English-speaking group, you got to be able to explain to them what's going on. And this is the burden of the city. And, I mean, kudos to this, to the city council on passing an ordinance to create a more inclusive agency as part of the city government. And, you know, obviously it's up to the mayor and the council to decide how to fund and make this agency at the city level into existence. But we've had an immigrant population here forever. I mean, the city is an immigrant city of Italians, Finns, and Irish. And, you know, different Asian communities have come in over the course of the 80s and 90s. And now we have people that basically represents the whole world down in Quincy Point from all over the globe. And it is indicative of government to go to those folks, not wait for those folks to come to you, which I think is an awful form of approach in government. They think it's the job of the population to come to them, and they can ignore them, as opposed to changing the government to reflect the population's need. I mean, I'll give you some example. This is an old city. People know this. We're well advanced age. But notice city services has been designed to address an older population. But then when we started having more children again, school systems started to fill. As a result, we shifted our services also back into map expansion of schools. You didn't wait for a riot of parents coming down demanding the schools to you. So changing immigrant population in language speakers is something that should be done at my level. You know, we talked this word earlier during the pandemic. We kept the legislature as a whole. It was like, why didn't you do, where were these language services before? How can we have, you know, people who have language challenge skills and able to communicate with health services and DUA? You know, I have my bill on data disaggregation to have the state collect better data on our demographics to get a better idea of our different segments to make sure that no one's underserved.
Yeah, you can't serve them unless you know they're there. That's right.
And, you know, and it's very easy to not serve people you can ignore because they're not there to begin with. And insufficient information on collecting that data has been important. The census information, I opposed the federal government, the Trump administration, for acquiring the citizenship question. It's irrelevant for the purpose of disproportionment of federal government funds, as well as district reapportionment. The district lines do not depend on citizenship. It's a residency count pursuant to the Constitution. So what's the relevance of it all? Just because you just want data for no purpose? Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I already have the information sort of through the Social Security Department. And yes, you can get Social Security number if you're on a visa status, but they will have that breakdown information of who has a Social Security numbers based on the different legal statuses. So, you know, a lot of this stuff is kind of a red herring out there that causes just either fear or paranoia in folks. And I do not succumb to fear and paranoia as people have dealt with me in the past. I do like to express what I consider rational, legitimate concerns as I've done through COVID-19. So You know, my attitude's always been very simple. I mean, it's the responsibility of the government to serve its people, know who they are, and change its government around to service those folks. And we've done it. You can't say we haven't done it. It's up to the will and desire to do so.
Well, on that note, how do folks get a hold of you, Jackie?
Well, we'll see what angry calls come in this week. 617-722-2014, 617-722-2014. That is the number to the office. Hit anyone. Don't be picky. Just hit anyone in my office. They'll get a voicemail, and we'll listen to them and get back to you as quickly as we can. We do prioritize based on need. So right now, unemployment calls are our number one need. My number one email was unemployment calls right now. I mean, I'm averaging no less than two a day. Hmm. That's an average per day, which means some days they get 15, some days they get one.
Right.
So it's a lot when you think about the size of my district. You can email me at tacky.chan@mahouse.gov, tacky.chan@mahouse.gov, and express your concerns. But again, we're prioritizing people with immediate needs first. And my email box is rapidly filling because people looking for co-sponsoring. Virtual events have now begun regarding educational seminar and advocacy groups during this time of year. We have a lot of folks that are trying to get me to come to their virtual events to make their presentations and advocate for their issues. So we're trying to figure out the schedule of that stuff. And of course, budget's rolling around really fast. So yes, my budget meeting is being scheduled now with the chair, what amazing means. My Facebook website, State Representative Tacky Chan, it is a public site. You do not need to be a Facebook member. It is now full of stuff. You can scroll down and try to find service information. And it's also duplicated at tackychan.org.
Okay, many ways.
You can skip over direct contact if you can find some information there.
Okay, and hopefully next time we talk, the vaccination website for the state will be better.
I will hope so. If you are comfortable, obviously check with your primary physician and any doctors groups involved. I know, like I said earlier, Atrius Healthcare, Harvard Vanguard has reached out to me regarding 65 and over when vaccinations become available. Again, they're going to open up the scheduling process, or they will contact you if you suffer from a serious medical condition, like my mom has received from a Tufts Medical. BI is opening vaccination, or has opened one in State Street Bank Complex, again, to address their most vulnerable populations first. It's going to enroll, but can't wait to get to us, Joe, because, I mean, it's going to be like over 2.7 million people. When I get to our section of the
you think things are crazy now. Just wait till then, exactly.
Wait to that part, folks. We're going to get to the largest chunk, which is the under 65 group.
Right.
It's going to be pretty interesting how that plays out, much less when we get to children later on as the clinical testing continues.
That's right, yeah. We'll see what the J&J vaccine does. That would expedite things, certainly just a one-shot vaccine.
Yeah, I think you're going to have a little bit of a rough ride through the FDA review process, it sounds like so far, because they're now wavering whether or not you need a second shot. And the efficacy rate regarding it's now being questioned a little bit, according to some news reports.
Okay.
I think you might, this end of the month, doing the FDA review, I think you're going to have a little bit of a harder time.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens.
Wait and see what happens. That's what we can do.
Until then, stay healthy. Be well, Tacky.
Stay up and be well, and we'll catch up in a week.
Sounds good.